regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad that you are with me today. We're going to be talking with Stephen Gutowski of The Reload here in just a moment, going over the oral arguments in Vanderstock at the Supreme Court yesterday. I also want to talk about Kamala Harris's interview on 60 Minutes where she was asked, okay, so what type of gun do you own? And she said, Glock. And then the hard-hitting follow-up, have you ever fired it? And that was it. That was the extent of the gun questions for Kamala Harris. Steve and I both have a lot of questions for Kamala Harris about her gun ownership, and more importantly, how her claims of gun ownership comport or contradict the policy positions that she has taken over the years. We'll talk about that here in just a minute or two. Before we get to Stephen Gutowski, though, I do want to let you know about something new from Town Hall Media. You know, you've heard me talk about our VIP and VIP Gold programs. Now you can become a VIP Platinum member of Town Hall Media. And this is a very exciting. You get all kinds of cool benefits that are not available to the VIP and VIP Gold members. So you can, if you're already a VIP or VIP Gold member, we thank you very much for your support, but also would encourage you to upgrade your membership to a VIP Platinum account. You can directly contact your favorite Town Hall Media writers, including myself. You will get access to Town Hall TV, so a library of feature films, documentaries, shows, all with, let's say, the right frame of mind. And you will get a lifetime discount on your purchases from the Town Hall Media store. Yes, we do have a merch store. You can finally get your Bearing Arms items. And if you become a VIP Platinum member right now, you will get, I believe it's a $25 gift card to use in the Town Hall Media merch store. So just use the promo code FIGHT right now, and you get all one word, all capital letters, FIGHT. When you subscribe, you can become a VIP Platinum member for 60% off of the regular membership rate. So again, I would encourage you to check it out. Just go to bearingarms.com/subscribe. Again, use that promo code FIGHT and become a VIP Platinum member today. All right, let's get to our conversation with Stephen Gutowski, founder of The Reload, one of my favorite Second Amendment journalists out there. Got a lot to discuss, so take a look and a listen. Stephen, thanks for coming back on the show. It's good to see you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And since my Red Sox did nothing to speak of this year, good luck to your Phillies in the playoffs. Yeah,
hopefully they don't lose out tonight. That would be very sad, but we'll see.
All right. So we did see a sort of I guess it was a championship fight for Vanderstock v. Garland yesterday at the Supreme Court. And, you know, I listened to the oral arguments. My first impression was that it did not. I think Pete Patterson did a great job for FPC, but I got the sense that the justices, maybe more than five of them, had essentially made up their mind, or at least they were already leaning in one direction, just based on some of the questions that we got yesterday. What's your take on what you heard during the oral arguments?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously reading tea leaves from the Supreme Court oral arguments is always tricky at best. But, you know, I definitely saw that was most people's impression that the plaintiffs here, the gun rights advocates, were in a rough spot. And certainly there were times where that was obviously true, like Barrett, when the plaintiff's lawyer was presenting one of the alternative like ways of judging when an unfinished part becomes a firearm, an unfinished receiver becomes a receiver under the law. And he was talking about, you know, machining, all of the crucial machining being finished. She literally said, well, isn't that a made up standard? Isn't that just something that the industry and the ATF made up on their own? It doesn't really come from the law. You know, there were certainly moments like that that made it seem like they weren't as receptive to at least the fallback options that the plaintiffs were presenting as like the alternative to the ATF's rule. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know that I heard like an obvious majority of on exactly where these guys are going to come down, because there was questioning about there's a lot of focus on the idea that the ATF wants to use this readily convertible standard that's from a different section of the Gun Control Act and sort of transplant it onto the section that deals with frames and receivers. And that, there was a lot of questioning of this as like, how can you do that? How does that make sense? It doesn't say that in the statute. But, you know, at the end of the day, I did feel like listening to it, you know, because you could go into it with this thought, oh, after, you know, the Cargill case, or even the case that effectively struck down Chevron deference, that this the court's just going to be pretty skeptical of all these rules that the ATF is coming up with to kind of extend their authority beyond maybe what the obvious meaning of the statutes they're working from are. And instead, I did get the feeling that maybe they're really just going to go through every single one of these cases, every rule, and try and determine themselves whether it's the best reading of the law. That's kind of what it felt like they were trying to do here.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, I mean, the government's contention that, well, listen, you know, this doesn't ban unserialized firearms. Folks can still build their own guns. They don't have to serialize them. All we're saying is if you buy one of these kits, you know, that these kits contain everything it needs to make a firearm. Well, clearly you're intending to build a firearm. And so let's treat that kit as a firearm. And have the unfinished frame and receiver serialized. You know, I got the sense that the justices, at least some of them, were open to that idea. Certainly the progressive wing of the court, I think, was all in favor of just letting the ATF do whatever they want. Sure. You know, but even Justice Kavanaugh at one point said that the government has a strong case to make. Something that didn't come up that I didn't catch any questions about this during the oral argument, you know, gun control groups have sued the ATF over this rule too, because they say that the ATF is not interpreting their rule or the statute correctly. They want to see not just the kits being regulated or fall under this rule, but they want unfinished frames and receivers sold by themselves to be treated as completed firearms. And the ATF has to date said, no, we're not going to do that. So that's a separate lawsuit. But I could see the, you know, if the Supreme Court does uphold the ATF rule as is being enforced and interpreted right now, I could see that opening the door to the ATF then further expanding this rule, even, you know, going forward and doing what the gun control groups are suing them and trying to force them to do.
Yeah, certainly. I will say that came up a little bit in some of the analogies that asked at one point about, like, well, you know, when does sort of the ingredients become the whole, right? You know, if I have all of the ingredients for a Western omelet laid out on my counter, is it a Western omelet at that point? Or is there some, you know, they're trying to make these, you know, philosophical draw the line of what's unfinished and what's completed. And then I think it was Barrett followed up with the idea of like, well, all right, you know, so it's essentially if I have eggs and I have, you know, peppers, does that mean I have a Western omelet if they're separate from each other or whatever, if I put them out together? And then Barrett followed up with this idea of like, well, what if they all come in a HelloFresh? She literally used the brand. I don't know if this was an ad read for
if product placement at SCOTUS.
Barrett is starting a podcast. She's got a YouTube channel coming, but yeah, she literally said like, well, what if it comes as a HelloFresh kit that's meant to be made this way? And so you can see kind of where they're trying to get at some of these things. Like the ATF is trying to contend that the kit, you know, these unfinished parts, maybe not on their own are, you know, firearms under the law, but if you put them together with the tools necessary to finish them in a relatively quick time, you know, there's sort of a time aspect. They didn't get real deep into the time aspect, which is kind of interesting because I feel like the time aspect is kind of important. The ATF says like 8 hours in a machine shop. Well, you could go from with today's technology, you could pretty easily go from just a block of aluminum to a finished AR receiver with 8 hours in a machine shop. Like it's not. So, you know, they didn't really get too deep into that stuff, but they did try to get into some of this, you know, is the I think the plaintiff's lawyer brought up like the tool, the template used in some of these kits, they don't talk about that at all in the law. There's no ban on selling templates alongside unfinished things. That doesn't make them receive it. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, what you got down to is You know, in contrast to Cargill, where the definition of machine gun is pretty black and white, at the end of the day, I think that's kind of what the court determined in that case. With this case, the definition of frame and receiver is not laid out in the law itself. And so that may be ultimately why they end up giving the ATF more leeway, even though the ATF has previously had a very different standard on what constitutes a finished frame receiver. That just at the end, it might just be that there's a little more ambiguity in this section of federal gun law.
Yeah, I guess we will we'll wait and see. It's not like the decision is going to come out next week, so we have a ways to go before we know what the court is going to do. And in the meantime, you know, we've got other pending cases that the court could take. Snope versus Brown, maybe I think they're probably the most important one that's pending before the court. They've already granted cert to Mexico's lawsuit against U.S. gun makers, so that's going up for oral argument here in a couple of months. So it's going to be, you know, a busy time. And then, of course, depending on what happens with the election, you know, I hate to say it, but that could have an impact on what the court looks like when some of these cases are heard potentially, you know, which takes us to Kamala Harris's interview on 60 Minutes, where guns came up briefly. Stephen, we learned that Kamala Harris owns a Glock, or at least she says she owns a Glock, and that, yes, she's fired it. And that was the extent of the questions from 60 Minutes. I don't know about you, but when I watched that, I was yelling at my computer, why didn't you follow this up? I mean, okay, so she says she owns a Glock handgun. Why not ask, when did you buy it? Did you buy it before or after you supported a ban on handguns in San Francisco? Did you buy it before or after you supported a ban on handguns in Washington, D.C.? I mean, that to me is a legitimate question, and one that frankly is far more important than have you ever shot your gun? I mean, I don't really care if Kamala Harris goes to the range or not. I do care what she thinks the right to keep and bear arms really means, if anything.
Sure, certainly. And she did get asked when, and she gave a vague answer of she's had it for a long time, which is basically what she said since 2019 when she was first talking about owning a gun. And that does sort of, and you're right, that it raises these questions, because now maybe it wouldn't normally matter that much for an average person when they bought their gun. But in this particular circumstance, it matters quite a bit because of her history of supporting these total handgun bans, or even something like certifying micro-stamping as attorney general that made it so that Californian civilians could not buy modern models of handguns for about a decade until the state just recently stopped defending that declaration in court. And now, you know, the roster in California is changing. Even just having a Glock, though, that little bit of information we got does offer some, bring up more questions and offer some insights here, because, you know, she may have, Glocks are on the roster in California, right? But they're only on there by grandfathering, because
I say Gen 3, right? Hangar, but not Gen 4, Gen 5,
the
Gen
3s, not the newer ones, because what the roster does, right, is ban the sale of handguns that don't have magazine disconnectors, that don't have a loaded chamber indicator, a very specific kind of loaded chamber indicator as well, not a very popular kind, frankly. And then obviously when Kamala Harris was AG, she added the micro-stamping requirement. But even under the pre-micro-stamping stuff, Glocks don't qualify as quote-unquote safe handguns in California. The only reason you can buy them as a civilian is because they were being sold before the requirements went into place. You cannot buy, as you mentioned, the newer models of Glocks, even though they're functionally identical, essentially. You know, there's some tweaks over the years, but they're basically the same pistol they've been forever, which is why, one reason a lot of people like them and own them. But so like the fact she owns a Glock is interesting. I mean, and we still don't know if that Glock, maybe she does own a Gen 4 or Gen 5, because she was law enforcement. She may have been able to buy an off-roster gun. We don't know if she did or not. We don't know if she had it when she supported San Francisco's ban. We don't know if she had it when she supported DC's handgun ban. Like, the and we don't know why she changed her mind on handguns. Like, why? Or maybe she thinks other people shouldn't be able to own them, but she should. Like, there's a lot of questions here that she should answer, honestly, as somebody running for president.
Absolutely. It's also interesting, too, because, you know, Chicago is suing Glock, claiming that the company basically is refusing to change its design, that Glocks are readily converted. There's that phrase again. To full auto, right, through the use of switches, which are illegal to possess. The switches itself are considered machine guns under federal law. But we've also heard, in fact, James Comer, head of the House Oversight Committee, just issued a congressional subpoena to, I think it was Stephanie Feldman with the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention and Steve Dettelbach, asking, okay, so what did the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention know about this lawsuit? Were you in contact with the city of Chicago? Because allegedly there was a meeting with the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention and Glock, where the White House office said, hey, we want you to make these design changes. Glock said, no, we can't really do that. And then right after that meeting was held, that's when Chicago filed this lawsuit. Well, Kamala Harris is ostensibly in charge of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which brings up a whole other angle related to her ownership of Glock. One that I will admit, it's not necessarily easy to frame that question succinctly. You might have to give the audience a little bit of background, because I'm guessing the vast majority of 60 Minutes viewers have no idea that that meeting is alleged to have taken place, that Comer's, you know, issued these subpoenas, or that Chicago has sued this, the Glock. But that's still, to me, I think, an important consideration here is that, okay, so you own this type of pistol that your administration has taken an interest in and wants to see changes. I mean, again, that to me, it provides a legitimate avenue of inquiry about something that I think is far more important than whether or not Kamala Harris has ever gone to the range. And this
I think it gets, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, I think it gets at the larger point about, you know, it's fine if she's changed her mind on these things, if she's changed her position. That politicians do that, people do that. Donald Trump has done that over the years. He had a very different view on gun policy before he ran for president, you know, supported assault weapons bans in his books, you know, all this stuff. He's changed over the years, too. The thing is that I think she owes it to the public as a candidate for office to explain why she has changed her mind on these things, or why she did things the way she did. Like, If she owned this handgun at the point where she didn't think the Second Amendment protected handguns, and that she was backing a total ban on their possession for most San Francisco residents, why did she do that? Like, what is her thought process? Why? What explains these things? Because they're legitimate. This is stuff that happened. This is stuff she did. It's her record, and I think we deserve answers on that. And you know, maybe they're not going to be answers that satisfy a lot of gun rights activists. I doubt she's going to change a lot of people's minds who are committed gun rights activists. But, you know, that's not the point. Like, she needs to explain her positions as a candidate for office, just like Donald Trump does. You know, these are things that are universal, in my view, as a reporter. And I don't think that she should get some sort of free pass. And you're, and I'm like, you know, it's fine to ask her basic questions about her gun. She hadn't somehow answered what kind of gun. I don't know why this was such a like hard thing to draw out of her when it's a pretty basic piece of information. But so that he did, you know, the 60 Minutes did get something on the record. It just would have been nice to get more and more substantial stuff, rather than sort of your extremely base level biography stuff.
I've got a very cynical theory about that. And I think that Kamala Harris is not answering these basic questions, or at least delaying answering these very basic questions, so that she can, you know, kind of put this out in dribs and drabs. And then that's what the media focuses on. So she's not, if the question becomes, you know, okay, so when did you own a gun? What type of gun do you own? Again, as you say, these sort of biographical questions, mm-hmm. We're not talking policy, right? We're not talking, okay, so why did you change your mind on a mandatory buyback of so-called assault weapons? Why did you support a ban on handguns, right? All of those are sort of natural, I think natural questions for reporters to ask. But instead, either intentionally or unintentionally, these reporters are, I think, barking up the wrong tree. They're going after those biographical details. And in some cases, I do think it's in an effort to aid her campaign. In other cases, it may be because you've got reporters who don't know the issue. And you and I have talked about this a lot before. There are a lot of reporters out there, and I'm guessing most of the folks who sit down with Kamala Harris, they're not Second Amendment focused, may not be gun owners themselves, may not be aware of all of these, other questions that come about as the result of her claims to own a Glock and things of that nature. So they focus on the wrong things, right? And I think that the Harris campaign is, I believe they're aware of that. And that is a strategy of, okay, well, let's just put this out dribs and drabs. And then, you know, maybe by the time Election Day rolls around, we haven't answered any substantive questions about, well, when did you change your mind about the right to own a handgun? Or did you change your mind about the right to own a handgun? Why do you no longer think it's a good idea to have a mandatory buyback of the guns that you want to ban? Things of that nature. Because, I mean, listen, we're less than a month away from Election Day. So she doesn't have to stall much longer, right? And she's been able to hold out for a couple of months without having to answer these basic questions.
Well, I have a slightly different theory of it.
Okay.
Because I do agree that I think this is intentional on the campaign's part. I don't think they want to get very deep into these questions. I don't think they want the harder aspect of this to be the focus of coverage of Kamala Harris's gun ownership. I will say that reporters are, I mean, obviously I'm asking these questions
sure.
to them and they're not responding.
Well, that's the thing,
you've
right?
also seen, right. That what they'll do is just not respond to the ones they don't want to answer. And I don't know. I don't even know if they wanted to reveal that she had a Glock. She might've just felt she had to, because she got directly asked in this big interview, which again, underlines, maybe I would wish, you know, we'd like to see a little more substantive questions alongside the what model of gun you own question, but because she is kind of in the hot seat in that situation, like she just refused. I mean, she didn't say exactly what kind of Glock she owned either. So to be clear, right. like she didn't, she only gave
what
us
kind of car do you drive? A Ford. Right. Yeah.
Right. But, the New York Times even asked her campaign about the 2005 handgun ban, and they didn't respond to the New York Times either. So some people are asking these questions. They're just, I think the campaign doesn't want to get into the, for the exact reasons we're talking about here, because then they'd have to explain why she owned a handgun when she used to want to ban possession of handguns. Like, how does that track? And then why did she change her mind, or has she changed her mind, right? Or does she just feel she has a special exceptions to be able to own handguns and other people shouldn't? Because, you know, maybe she talks about it in context of her law enforcement background. And there are people who think, well, only police should own handguns. And so I don't know, is that her view? We don't know, because she doesn't say. So, you know, she's definitely wants that they clearly want it to be much more focused on the vibes of it. Right. People talk about vibes in this election all the time, and they want to be out there and counter this idea that she's very radical on guns. You know, they don't want to talk about the policy side. They want to talk about how she's a gun owner like you. She owns a handgun, a Glock. She doesn't want to take your guns away. That's proof of it. And look, I think this is not a new tactic. You've seen Democrats use this before. Joe Biden, Tim Walz, great examples. I think she has a little bit more of a better case for it. She's doing it in a more believable way, or at least a way that's probably going to connect with more people. Because generally, what you'd see is Democrats go out and say, "I own a shotgun for hunting, and you don't need any of these other guns, or I just want common sense guns, or whatever." This is a common line, right? It's not new, but Kamala Harris, her line is, "I own a handgun for self-defense." And that is much more in line with why the kind of gun most Americans buy and the reason most Americans buy a gun. So it does, on the vibes level, at least on a sort of relatability level, it's a better argument than what Tim Walz was bringing to the table, for instance. So, you know, it may well work. And I think it's obvious that's why they want to focus on that part of it and not on all these thorny policy questions. Because they're not trying to get, you know, gun rights activists.
Right.
I don't think they think they're going to get this. In fact, they want to keep the gun control activists. That's why their policy positions haven't really changed that much. Right. She doesn't want a buyback, but she still wants an assault weapons ban, mm-hmm. which is a pretty aggressive policy for a Democratic presidential candidate over the last 25 years, right? Since Al Gore. So it's a, you know, I think it's clear why the big messages that they put out in a 60 Minutes interview or, you know, when she's talking to Oprah or at the debate is, I own a gun. I'm not going to take your guns. You don't have to be afraid of that from me. And then the more focused stuff when they're talking about policy is the same agenda that they've had, you know, for the last since Biden was elected. She's just running on his basic policy platform.
Yeah.
And I think that's why. And they don't want to get into anything else. I don't think they want to talk about anything else beyond that.
Yep, I think you're right. But it's why I think, you know, what you're doing at The Reload is so important. Why what we're doing at Bearing Arms is so important. Truth About Guns and some of these other outlets that are actually asking these questions and, more importantly, providing readers with the information that they need. And again, you know, listen, you've got a gun owning audience. I've got a gun owning audience. I don't think that these our audience by and large is huge fans of Kamala Harris to begin with. But at least the information that you're putting out there, that we're putting out there, is information that gun owners can take and then use that to talk to their family and friends and say, OK, don't you find it weird that Kamala Harris doesn't want to talk about these things? I find it very odd that, you know, when she was asked, why did you buy a gun? And she just kind of, like you said, she hemmed and hawed and said, well, I'm in law enforcement. That's one of my favorite questions to ask people is, you know, why did you become a gun owner? Because to me, there's usually a good story involved, even if it's, well, I grew up around guns and, you know, my dad took me hunting when I was a kid, or my grandpa took me to the range and I went plinking. I earned my, you know, Eagle Scout badge. Or, you know, there was some incident that forced me to rethink my thoughts on self-defense and rethink my thoughts on gun ownership. And I realized I want to be able to protect myself. You didn't get any of that from Kamala Harris, right? There was no, and there has to be some sort of conversion story at some point, because as you say, she was in favor of a handgun ban in San Francisco. She was in favor. She argued to the Supreme Court that they should not interpret the Second Amendment as protecting an individual right to keep and bear arms. It wasn't just that she defended DC's handgun ban. She said, no, the courts have said for 70 years it's not an individual right. You need to keep it that way. So if she's now saying, oh, well, I own a gun for self-defense, I'm not taking anybody's guns away, presumably there would have to have been some sort of evolution, some sort of change of heart on the issue that may or may not be related to her personal gun ownership. Why are we hearing that story? I mean, that's, and again, it's a hypothetical question. I know you don't know the answer to that, or maybe we do know the answer to that, but it's just,
you know, I think a lot of it's, she's sort of implying why, through, you know, discussions of, well, I was a prosecutor, I was in law enforcement. It implies to me, at least, it implies without saying, that she was threatened at some point. And that is a perfectly legitimate reason to buy a gun, of course, but she, you're right. I mean, honestly, I don't know that she's doing a great job of selling the vibes part of it. Like she's, you know, the Oprah thing where she joked about somebody breaks into her house, they're going to get shot. That was pretty, a pretty good line and pretty candid. Cause it's sort of, even if you're a gun control activist, you know, I think people can connect with that, on a, you know, base level of like, you know, don't try to hurt me or it's not going to go well for you. Yeah, that was the closest thing I think to being a more natural, like, way somebody might actually talk about their gun ownership, as opposed to like, you're right. She doesn't talk about, she sort of just says, oh, I was in law enforcement in the 60 Minutes interview, right? Like, what does that mean? Like, do you, one, is it just law enforcement tend to own guns? Or are you trying to say that you were threatened as part of being law enforcement? Because that was the story back in 2019. And it seemed, I don't know why, I don't think it's changed. I just think she doesn't really articulated it very well. She just says, oh, law enforcement. And I think everyone is supposed to assume, oh, well, she gets threats. And she probably does, right? But she could do a much better job of talking about it and you know, putting herself out there more naturally as a gun owner and talk, you know, if it is a natural part of her. I don't know that she, how into guns she really is. Obviously she's never really seemed very into firearms, not that you have to be to own one, but
right.
But you know, it one of those things where, like, you're right, I think she, I don't know that she's even doing a bang up job of doing the vibes thing on the gun ownership side. And also, like, to your point earlier, you know, she could be the next president. She has a pretty good shot of being the next president. And so whether you support her or you support Donald Trump or whatever, I think people deserve to know what her position is on this stuff. It's important. It's very important stuff. And so, like, even if I, you know, however you feel about the candidates, they should answer these questions, and it should be out there in public, and it should be, it's an important part of what we do as reporters and journalists and people in the media, that this just the job. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter how you feel about the individual candidate. You should just be out there trying to get answers for your audience.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you say, I mean, there are some outlets that are asking these questions. She's just not, and her campaign is just not providing answers. But I appreciate all of the work that you are doing to try to bring these policy positions to light. And again, I would encourage folks, if you aren't reading The Reload, you need to be reading The Reload. In fact, you need to become a member of The Reload. You'll get subscriber exclusive stories. You'll have all kinds of other great benefits. So check out thereload.com. You know, I'm not even going to make you do that pitch, Stephen. I'll do it for you today. But hey, man, I always appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to doing this again very, very soon.
Hey, thank you.
And go Phillies.
Yes.
My thanks again to Steve for joining us on the program today. Looking forward to having him back again very, very soon. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story from the website CWB Chicago reporting on the arrest of two migrants from Venezuela who've been arrested 10 times this year, not in Venezuela, but here in the United States, in fact, in the Chicago area, who are now accused of burglarizing a restaurant storage shed at Oak Street Beach. According to CWB Chicago, 31-year-old Johnny Montez Alexander and 25-year-old Oscar Garcia Adrian arrested as they walked along the lakefront trail with a power washer, a toolbox, and some bolt cutters, according to a police report filed by the Chicago PD. The owner of the restaurant called 911 after he saw a video feed showing two men burglarizing the restaurant storage shed back on September 30th. Officers responded. They found the shed had been broken into, but nobody was around. According to CWB Chicago, however, it did not take them long to find a couple of suspects. Adrian and Alexander spotted a short distance away on a bike path with the power washer and the toolbox that allegedly belonged to the restaurant. Adrian told arresting officers that the two men left the power washer and other items on the lakefront, and he was just taking ownership of them. Well, that didn't work. Prosecutors have charged both men with burglary and possession of burglary tools after the restaurant owner provided video of them breaking into the shed. According to CWB Chicago, at the time of the Whispers incident, Whispers is the name of the restaurant that was burgled, Adrian was on pretrial release for retail theft. Shoplifting charges filed after a TJ Maxx employee accused Adrian of stealing a piece of luggage from the store located in Chicago's Loop on June the 10th. He also has arrests this year for battery in July, retail theft in May, retail theft in April, theft in April. And prosecutors dropped all of those cases. Every single one of them. Now, CWB Chicago also reports that Alexander's court file shows that he pleaded guilty to felony retail theft on September 17th. In that case, he and an accomplice allegedly stole three pieces of luggage worth more than $1,500 from a Macy's on State Street back in February of this year. Chicago police report said that he told officers he was, quote, stealing to go back to Venezuela. So after he pleaded guilty to a felony charge of retail theft, he got a sentence of, you ready for this? 54 days. That's it. And according to the website, he was able to complete that sentence. In fact, he had already completed that sentence because the court gave him credit for wearing an ankle monitor while his case was pending. While he was on pretrial release for the theft allegations, he was arrested for another case of retail theft in April, and in July, he was arrested in Chicago for obstruction of identification. Again, prosecutors dropping both of those cases. So, what, 10 arrests between these two individuals, and what, 8 drop charges, maybe 9 drop charges in Cook County? This is insane. What on earth are prosecutors doing here to deal with repeat offenders? Now, in this case, none of these crimes were crimes of violence, but you still had, again, a pattern of criminality here. And I guarantee, listen, you know, Macy's might be able to cover the loss of $1,500 worth of luggage, But it's not like this is the only theft that they're dealing with, right? And small businesses are really beleaguered here. They are finding it difficult to operate in some circumstances because of the amount of retail theft that's taking place. And again, prosecutors are turning a blind eye to this. Why? Oh, that's right, because it's Chicago. They're more worried about going after legal gun owners. Today's Armed Citizen story from El Cerrito, California, where a police say a suspected home intruder was shot by a homeowner on a Tuesday afternoon. According to authorities, the homeowner is about 10:30. I said it was yesterday afternoon. It was actually yesterday morning, about 10:30 in the morning. Officers responded to a reported shooting. When they got on scene, they located a 56-year-old man with injuries, identified as a transient from West Contra Costa County. He was airlifted to a trauma center for treatment of his injuries. The resident of the home was detained, but after an investigation, police believe that the resident shot the intruder after he unlawfully entered the home. El Cerrito police in a Tuesday afternoon press release said the resident realized that the suspect was an unknown intruder and thought that he was armed with a weapon. The resident feared for his life and shot the suspect twice with a shotgun. Investigators also determined that the suspect did not have a weapon on him. But police say they still do anticipate bringing a criminal case to the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office for burglary. Meanwhile, no charges anticipated against the homeowner, although given, again, California's hostility towards the Second Amendment, that could change. So we will be keeping an eye on what's going on out there in El Cerrito, California, just to make sure that the DA doesn't do anything to go after the homeowner who acted in defense of his life when the sanctity of his home was invaded. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A teenager and his stepfather in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, who came to the aid of a woman whose home was on fire, rushing into the flames and the smoke to save her and I believe her dogs as well. This happened about 5 o'clock on Monday morning in Ephrata, Pennsylvania. Neighbors heard the fire alarm. 17-year-old and his stepfather ran over to the home, went inside. The 17-year-old picked up the woman who lived there, carried her out. The teen and his stepfather then went back inside the home to rescue several dogs. The 17-year-old neighbor and the resident, who was the only person inside the home at the time, both taken to the hospital for burns and for smoke inhalation. The 17-year-old suffering burns to his face and arms. There were about 12 crews that responded to the fire. Most of the damage contained to the second floor of the home. They say they're not sure how the fire started. And thankfully, again, the woman not seriously injured. It sounds like the 17-year-old is going to be okay as well. It could have been a very different situation had that 17-year-old not acted with the courage and bravery that they displayed in running into this burning home and rescuing the neighbor inside. So I wish I had a name to give you. Hopefully we'll find out more about the heroic teen we just talked about. But for now, anonymous 17-year-old in Ephrata, Pennsylvania, we thank you and your stepfather for a very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Just a reminder again, if you want to become a VIP Platinum member, we would love to have you. All you have to do, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe, use the promo code FIGHT, and take 60% off your VIP Platinum membership. You can contact your favorite Town Hall Media authors directly. You've got access to a library of conservative media through Town Hall TV, and you get to save some money on your favorite Town Hall Media merch when you visit the merch store. Again, just use that promo code FIGHT to get 60% off your VIP Platinum membership. We'll see you back here tomorrow with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Thank you again for being a part of the show today. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.